On December 17th, Dr. Edward Michelson, the chair of the emergency department at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, joined Anthony Moreno for Issues and Answers. He talked about the city's terrible fall surge.
We led the country, unfortunately and fortunately, in terms of the timing of our surge. Obviously, it's unfortunate because it's really strained all of our families and our health system. The fortunate part is that because we led the rest of Texas, we had a lot of resources made available to us that might not be available if our surge coincided with that of the other bigger cities in Texas.
Today, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions on Voice of the Public. Dr. Michelson joins us right after NPR News, 575-646-2212, to join the conversation. Good afternoon. It's 106. Welcome to Voice of the Public, back for the new year with Dr. Edward Michelson, the chair of the emergency department at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center and a member of El Paso's COVID Task Force. Good afternoon, Dr. Michelson. Thank you for being with us today.
Good afternoon, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, we wanted to focus on El Paso and had actually hoped to do so before the holidays, but in a way, it worked out for the best because now we get to talk about a lot more, including vaccine distribution. But let's get back to that that awful fall surge that El Paso experienced. And I'd just like to know what your perspective is on how that, why that happened, and how are things looking now?
Why that happened is the million-dollar question. I don't think anyone has the answer to that. But what we went through in early to mid-November is what's happening now in many other parts of the country and is what's taking up a lot of the news coverage, particularly from California right now. So to give you a perspective, around the 12th, 13th, 14th of November, El Paso County peaked at about 1,140 patients simultaneously in hospital with COVID-19. That represented over half of the beds occupied by patients with COVID. And for perspective, as of this morning, we're now down around 400. So we've dropped from 1,100 down to 400. The number in ICU at the peak was in the 330, 335 range, and we're at half that now, 162, 163. And the number on ventilators is just below 100. So we had a really tough time there in November, and so far, touch wood, we're doing much better.
What about a post-holiday surge? It's 2 weeks from Christmas. Are we starting to see those numbers going back up?
Well, we're holding our breath.
Yeah.
I was very concerned about Thanksgiving because by Thanksgiving, things were starting to look better here. And we all thought we might see a post-Thanksgiving surge. Fortunately, that did not happen. Our numbers continued to go down. Christmas and New Year's is a different story. The way we gauge what's going to happen, sort of the prediction, like following the weather with the with the barometric pressure, I watch the positivity rate. So every day on EP Strong, you can go in and see the estimate of the number of active cases. You can also see the number of people who tested positive. That number is not a scientific number in the sense that it depends on how many people actually go for tests.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, on Christmas Day, on New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, we had very few new positives reported because people weren't getting tested. If you look, though, at the percent of patients who come up positive on that test, that's an indicator of what's happening in the community, and we see those numbers move before we see hospitalizations change. In the last week, that number's going up. We were at about 7.3% positivity the last day or two of 2020. And as of yesterday, we're up to almost 11%. So that's about a 50% increase in the number of people testing positive. This may be our first indication of a post-holiday surge. And if that trend continues, we'll start seeing hospitalizations go up in another week to 10 days.
575-646-2212 is the number to call if you have a question for Dr. Michelson this afternoon. He'll be with us until 2 o'clock, and we appreciate the time because it for you and every other healthcare worker, this last year has had to, how do you keep going?
You know, it's really, I've described this as like a marathon. You know, we all remember the unfortunate events August a year ago with the terrible shooting incident here in El Paso. Boy, that was a sprint. That was unexpected, and everybody was up to speed quickly, and we had to take care of too many injured patients in a very short period of time, and then it was over. Medically speaking, you know, the acute part of that was over. There were patients in the hospital for a long time with surgeries and recoveries. This, in comparison, has been a marathon. We had a small surge back in late July, and things were getting better in August and in September. So when we started seeing numbers go up in October into November, it was a little unexpected, but at least we were prepared. At least we knew what was coming. We had made arrangements. We had protocols and procedures in place. So it didn't feel quite as terrible as what we saw on TV, for instance, in the spring in New York.
What were those COVID task force meetings like from the early stages? Take us into that room and tell us what it was like trying to make plans for this.
Well, of course, you know, in this age of COVID, it wasn't a room. We were all meeting on Zoom or WebEx.
Forgive me.
It was our virtual room, right? We were meeting on screen. But we had quite a few meetings. And the purpose, really, of the task force was to get the medical minds together with the leadership of the county, of the city, with Border RAC, to assess the status of the hospital system and to make recommendations to the city and county leadership on steps that they might need to take in order to help moderate the pandemic. And honestly, I think we did a pretty good job because, yes, we got very close to saturation, but we never got to the point of denying care or having to ration care, which are conversations going on right now in Southern California. The hospitals did an amazing job of adding more beds. We brought in over 1,400 healthcare providers to staff those beds from other parts of Texas, other parts of the country. A number of those folks are still here, although gradually that number will decline. And we just kept things going. We never denied anyone care. Everyone got great care at a time when we massively increased our capacity of our hospitals.
We have a caller on the line, Tricia Holding, with a question, 575-646-2212. If you have a question for Dr. Edward Michelson, member of the El Paso COVID Task Force this afternoon. Hi, Tricia. How are you?
Hi.
Go ahead with your question.
Oh, okay. I hope that somebody will give some thought for another way to register for the vaccinations other than by computer, because there are an awful lot of awful old people, one of which I am one, who do not have computer access and can't afford it.
I think one of the things we need to specify here, Tricia, is are you in El Paso or are you in somewhere in New Mexico?
I'm in Las Cruces.
In Las Cruces. So New Mexico does have its online registration, but I do know that they have started a call center to help people get registered. And I wouldn't expect necessarily that Dr. Michelson, would you be able to speak to...
Oh, okay. That's fine. I had a feeling that was true, but I get really frustrated because just because I'm poor doesn't mean I'm not real, you know? And and think about all those little kids sitting outside the Dairy Queen doing their homework because they don't have computer access in their house.
That's right, Tricia. And a lot more people are feeling the economic pain, certainly as a result of this pandemic. So if you want to stay holding on the line, we will do our best to get you that.
I just wanted to pass that on because I'm still real, even though I don't have a computer.
And we're so happy you're here with us today. Thank you, Tricia.
Thanks for your question. And that's really a great point. Understand that this is all happening incredibly quickly. The whole vaccine program has been on an accelerated pace. I'm really impressed with how quickly the companies have been able to design, manufacture, and produce millions of doses of vaccine. And the federal government, I think, has done a pretty good job of figuring out how to push it out to different states, and then the states are allocating their vaccine allotments to the different cities. What we didn't do well was prepare to actually administer the vaccine. Mm-hmm. To give a large number of doses of vaccine in a short period of time, you've identified one of the key bottlenecks, and that is, how do you get people signed up and registered? The easiest thing to do, if you already have a web presence, is to put up a new website. You can do that in a matter of a day or two. The harder thing to do is to set up a call center.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine if you have literally 10, 20,000 people phoning a call center. It takes time to get the phones, to get the people, to give them the resources to actually process those calls and get people in line. And this is true all over the country. This is not unique to Las Cruces or El Paso. So I can tell you we've, as recently as earlier this week, had a big discussion here in El Paso about how we can ramp up that process to get people into the queue so they can get their vaccine as soon as possible.
That's one of the things that people, you know, are like you said, everywhere. People are expressing frustration about how to get one of these vaccines. What is available right now in El Paso?
Well, the number keeps changing. So I was just looking at that before I joined you this morning, and there is actually a website that Texas has that's open to the public. As of this morning, there have been 24,600 individuals who've received their first dose, and they state that a little over 800 have gotten their second dose. So just to remind everybody, this vaccination requires two doses. The Pfizer vaccine, those doses are 3 weeks apart. The Moderna vaccine are 4 weeks apart, and we actually have a mix of both arriving here in El Paso. I personally got my first dose of the Pfizer 3 weeks ago, and on Wednesday I got my second dose. So I'm one of those 800 with a second dose. Many of the hospitals, though, this week are busily giving their frontline providers their second doses.
Mm. And we have a question from Cassie on Facebook. By the way, we are streaming live on Facebook if you would like to follow us there. And you can always feel free to comment if you don't want to call and be on the radio. We're happy to take your comments there as well. Cassie asks, have there been discussions about vaccines for children?
Yeah. Children are going to be the next group that really is being studied now to look at the safety and effectiveness. It's not uncommon when we have a new drug or a new vaccine that we start that process with adults, and usually it's non-pregnant adults.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason for that is a consent. When you're involved in a study, you have to give informed consent. You have to understand the risks and the benefits and make a decision. The consent issues with kids is much more complicated because typically there's a parent or a guardian, and the child gives assent, but the parent gives consent. So most new drugs and vaccines start with adults. No one wants to leave the kids out. We're also mindful, however, that children overall have a very low rate of getting very sick from COVID. We know that COVID infections are spread among children, and most of them will have few symptoms, or the symptoms they have will be mild. So it's not that we don't want to protect kids, but the highest priority people to protect first are the ones that are the most vulnerable and the ones that are most likely to end up in hospital or dying. And those are people with advanced age, advanced body weight, or who have chronic medical conditions. So fortunately, since most of our kids are healthy, it's the right thing to do to have them come second after we take care of the others.
When we talk about the trials, I mean, who would want to offer up their child, you know, to an experimental vaccine?
So there is safety data from adults, and we expect that the safety data will look similar in children. But you're correct, Casey. That's another concern. That's why I think we try to do these studies in adults first.
And can I just say a shout out to those people, those tens of thousands of people who did offer themselves up for the rest of us?
Absolutely.
Now, let's move on to the new strains of the virus that we're seeing. I believe the UK strain has appeared in Texas.
The UK strain is popping up in different places in the United States. I think it's gotten pretty prevalent in parts of the United Kingdom, particularly around London. And we may not have an accurate picture of how many of the new strain, in fact, are here in the Southwest, in Texas, really anywhere in the United States. And the simple reason for that is we're not looking for it. In the United Kingdom, roughly 10% of all patients with a positive COVID test have the virus that's detected further analyzed for the type of virus. So viruses tend to mutate over time, which means their genetic code slightly alters. And those alterations are really due to errors. I mean, the virus is rapidly multiplying. You get many generations of virus. And during that process, a few of those viruses will change. The changes that give an advantage to the virus tend to propagate. So if the change makes the virus weaker or less infective, it'll disappear. It won't replicate. But if the change does something to make the virus more virulent, meaning that it's more likely to jump to another host and to multiply, it's going to increase in numbers, and it's gradually going to take over. So the only way to know that is to separately test for those mutants. In the United States, I think it's well below 1% of patients are being tested.
Hmm. Now, there's a strain in South Africa, I believe, that was leading to more symptoms and sickness in children. Is that the case?
So there's also a South Africa variant, which appears different than the one currently in the UK. I'm not aware of that one arriving in the United States yet, but I imagine it's only a matter of time before we will start seeing that one as well. What I've read about the UK variant is that it is more likely to infect other people who come in close contact than the current predominant virus here. However, it's not more likely to make you more sick. I don't know the information on the one from South Africa. But those are the things we watch. We watch for both the infectivity rate as well as severity of illness.
And it may be too early to say, but so far it seems pretty optimistic in terms of the vaccine still working with this one?
This is what we believe. But this is another reason that even though I've now had two doses of the vaccine, if you come into the ER when I'm working, you'll see me wearing my mask. If you bump into me in Walmart, you'll see me wearing my mask. So just because we're vaccinated doesn't mean that we can lighten up on mask wearing or hand washing. And we're still going to need to watch our social distancing.
I'm glad we got back to the topic of vaccines, because I did want to talk a little bit more about that, the reluctance. A lot of people are reluctant to get the vaccine. We've seen even in some places healthcare workers don't necessarily want to get the vaccine, maybe in much smaller numbers. But what message do you want to get out to people regarding the vaccine, its side effects, and why people should get it? And are there any people that should not get it?
So, yes, there's a caution potentially for those individuals who've had any type of a severe allergic reaction. They need to be monitored carefully, because they're at an increased risk of having a reaction to the vaccine. So far, that number has been very small. And the number of people who've actually had a severe reaction has been very small, and they've been successfully treated. The second group we just don't have enough information on are women who are pregnant. However, I think it's dangerous to get COVID while you're pregnant, both for the mom and for her unborn baby. So I think weighing all of the risks and benefits, it's still probably a good idea to get the vaccine, even if you're pregnant. But there are no specific recommendations for pregnant women. I'll tell you, here in El Paso, 95% of my colleagues, be they nurses, respiratory therapists, physicians, our medical students, our residents in training, are all signing up and getting the vaccine, because we are exposed daily, and we are trying to keep ourselves safe and protected so we can stay on the job.
So far, 2,900 healthcare workers have succumbed to this virus. I wonder if you feel like this pandemic will affect the healthcare industry in terms of people who want to make healthcare their profession.
I sure hope not. Yeah, my heart goes out for those individuals who've become infected and for those individuals who unfortunately passed away. I can speak to our experience here at University Medical Center. In my own department, we have had a handful of our team become infected with COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, none of them ended up in the hospital. And interestingly, most of them probably got infected away from the hospital. Most of them, we can trace their infection back to either a spouse, significant other, a friend who they were in close contact with away from the hospital. So I have no doubt some of us did, unfortunately, get exposed and became infected at work, but probably the majority of us did not. So I hope that also reassures people that if you need to come to the hospital, we really are doing everything we can to protect you from becoming infected if you're here for a reason other than COVID. And I have to say, all of our ERs have been unusually slow. People who should be coming when they have chest pain or they have signs of a stroke or their diabetes is out of control, they're staying away. They're afraid to come to the hospital because they're afraid of COVID exposure. I honestly feel safer at work than I do when I go to the big box store.
Yeah. 575-646-2212. Dr. Edward Michelson, a member of El Paso's COVID Task Force and the chair of the Emergency Department at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, on the line with us today for Voice of the Public. Thank you so much for tuning in, listening on the air at 90.7 FM, or if you're following along on Facebook, like Christian, who asks, how effective is the vaccine for those with an obese BMI index between 30 and 40?
Vaccines should be equally effective in those with high BMI versus those in low BMI. However, patients with a high BMI are at increased risk of becoming more ill if they do come down with COVID. So I would really encourage anybody who falls into that high weight category to get vaccinated as soon as they can. And let me also mention, while we're talking about that, the monoclonal antibody infusion program that we have going on here in El Paso. We have seen a number of patients with a BMI greater than 35 who have become infected with COVID, and when we catch them early, when they don't need to be hospitalized, we are referring them to receive the bamlanivimab monoclonal antibody infusion. There's also a similar product from Regeneron that is available at some of the hospitals. And I think this is very helpful in preventing those individuals from becoming so sick that they have to end up in the hospital.
That was next on my list, so perfect timing on that. I'm just calling it Bam Bam because I can't remember the full name. But and the full topic being other treatments that have kind of become available and maybe gotten tested a little bit more. Where else are you seeing successful treatments?
You know, we have some tools to help us take care of patients with COVID-19. We need more. And we need sharper tools than the ones we have now. When we started out, remdesivir, which is an antiviral agent, was one of the early tools we got. It helps. We think that it reduces length of hospitalization in patients who end up in the hospital. It doesn't seem to reduce mortality, but reducing length of stay in the hospital is a good thing when your hospitals are all full. So we're using it pretty liberally. We learned from our colleagues in the UK that certain steroids like dexamethasone for patients who are on oxygen therapy also yields some benefit. But the benefits from a number of these treatments really are only in the 10 to 20% range of improvement.
Dr. Michelson, I was surprised. A very close friend of mine got the virus, is in a very high-risk category, got very sick, went to the ER, got the Bam Bam treatment, but her doctor also gave her hydroxychloroquine, among many other drugs. Is that something that has been commonly prescribed in El Paso that you could speak to?
Early in the course of this disease, there was a lot of use of an antibiotic, azithromycin, as well as hydroxychloroquine. Subsequent data shows that hydroxychloroquine is probably of no benefit and may actually be of some harm. But this is a rapidly evolving science. So as we learn new things, those that work, we keep. Those that don't seem to work, we're no longer using.
Okay, we've got a couple of callers holding on the line. So let me get to Inigio If I said that correctly, Inigo, I get 5 points.
Well, Inigo.
Inigo, okay. I apologize. We were trying to get that pronunciation sorted out there, but failed miserably.
If you ever watch The Princess Bride, that's the name of one of the characters.
Gotcha. Well, welcome to Voice of the Public. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. Something of a follow-up question regarding the earlier answer about testing and how well it reflects what's going on in the community. And so you made a very good point that, of course, it depends on how many people get tested, the numbers that we see. But I'm also wondering, do you have a sense of whether people are going and being tested? Are people testing voluntarily just sort of to get a sense of where they are, or is it mainly people that are not feeling well or think they might have COVID? Because then at that point, if you have more people who are sick, then you're going to have higher numbers. And so I guess my general question is about how well those numbers actually reflect the numbers that are really out there in the community.
Yep, excellent question, and it's the right one to ask. The simple answer is this is not a scientific sampling. If we were doing scientific sampling, we would apply certain criteria to who we tested. We would try to do a controlled sample of people based on age, segregate those that have symptoms from those that don't, so we could get a clearer picture of what's going on. This is totally random. People get tested. Anyone who wants a test can get a test. You may recall early in the course of this pandemic, before we had huge numbers of cases across the country, the big discussion was availability of tests. And many states were complaining that they couldn't get enough tests, that we didn't have the ability to test everyone that wanted one. I think we're at a point now where we can pretty much test anybody who asks for a test. But people get tested for a variety of reasons. They may have been called and told that someone they were close to came down with COVID, so now they want to check and see if they have COVID, even though they have no symptoms. They may need to test because they just returned from a trip. Their work may require them to get a test to prove they don't have COVID if they're working in with a vulnerable population. So there's really many reasons people test, and there's no control over who is getting the test. So that's why we kind of have to look at positivity rates with a grain of salt. But I'll tell you, at our peak, our positivity rate was over 25%. So when you go from 25% to a nadir of about 7, obviously that's a lot better. And now that it's inching up again, I'm nervous.
Do you think we're testing enough people?
You know, I think we are. I really do. And we also don't truly know how many people in the community have COVID today or had COVID, because there's an awful lot of asymptomatic folks who have the infection and are probably spreading it. And since they don't typically go for testing if they feel well and if they don't realize they've been around someone with COVID, we truly don't know how many people in the community actually have COVID in their nose and are sneezing it out when they're in the stores or restaurants or wherever they may be. So this is the reason we can't let our guard down. Even though our numbers in the hospital look better, we're still all exposed. And the number of people in the community may, in fact, be 2 or 3 times as many as the number of active cases, which today is 34,500. There could be 100,000 people in our community who actually have COVID.
Wow. I would like to bring on our other caller who's been waiting patiently with her question. Susan, welcome to the show. Thank you for calling KRWG's Voice of the Public.
My question is, how do I know when I go to get my vaccination that there will be enough vaccine left for my second shot?
Yep. Great question, Susan. That's the plan. There's even some discussion now, and I heard news coverage this morning on NPR that the Biden administration is talking about pushing out all the doses that are available now and not holding back any doses. the assumption is that the manufacturers will continue to supply enough doses so that everyone will get their second dose. This has been a strategy that's currently being employed in the United Kingdom. In order to get more people a first dose, they're actually, in some cases, delaying second doses just to use those second doses to give another person their first dose. That is a strategy that has some theoretical merit, but it hasn't been tested. So I think the United States is wise to continue with going with the tested regimen, which is two doses 3 weeks apart for the Pfizer and two doses 4 weeks apart for the Moderna. So when you get your first dose, I hope that's soon, the center where you receive your dose should be able to commit to you a return date to get the second dose. That's how it's currently operating.
All right, Susan, thank you very much for calling 575-646-2212. If you have a question for Dr. Edward Michelson, who is the chair of the Emergency Department at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center and a member of El Paso's COVID Task Force, we get a lot of questions about how much border traffic has contributed to COVID-19 in El Paso, or even vice versa. What do you know about the situation as it stands with cross-border traffic and COVID-19?
Yeah, we know a lot of people do cross the border every day. For many, it's work reasons. For many, it's families that live on both sides of the border and are visiting each other. Although the border is in theory closed to casual travel, we know that there's still many people who legitimately come across the border every day. I don't think that we have good statistics on really what's going on in Juarez. I believe there's quite a few cases in Juarez and probably quite a few more than are being reported by the media. And the simple reason for that gets back to testing. Here in the United States, anyone can get a COVID test at absolutely no charge. My understanding is that free testing is very limited in Mexico, and that individuals who want to get tested in Mexico actually have to pay for the test, and it's pretty expensive. Of course, if you're a U.S. citizen residing in Juarez, there's nothing to stop you from coming across to El Paso and getting tested. So not sure how many of our positive tests here in El Paso represent individuals who actually reside in Juarez. The second concern I have is that the number of cases seems to correlate with the density of population. If you look at our zip code map on epstrong.org, you can see a colored map that shows where the cases are in El Paso. There's quite a few more cases in the eastern portions of the city where we know there's a higher density of population. Well, I think Juarez is much more densely populated than we are. So I would imagine that there are quite a few cases in Juarez that simply aren't being counted.
Mm. The incoming mayor, Oscar Leeser, has had a terrible loss in his family. His mother and his brother have both died of COVID-19. Do you think there is any chance that there will be a different approach under Mayor Leeser's leadership with COVID-19 in El Paso, or would that be necessary at this point?
No information. I'm sure that Mayor Leeser is very sensitive to the ravage that COVID can have on families. I think all of our politicians are in a tough place because a lot of the measures that we need to take to help keep the virus from spreading rapidly can have a negative impact on business and on economics. And we have to balance the need to keep people well, the need to not overwhelm the hospitals, with the need to keep our economy running, to keep people from being evicted, to make sure that they have adequate means and resources to eat and to take care of their families. My hope is, with the change of leadership in D.C., that we will see more resources coming out to the communities to support the cities and also to support individuals who need financial help to get through this time.
There was some discussion, of course, lots of discussion, on aid for state and local governments. And with the CARES Act, that aid came through. Texas received, I think, billions from that, if I'm not mistaken. And is that money filtering through to where it needs to be in the El Paso community?
You know, I don't know the numbers for El Paso. I hear stories, though, that the story is similar to the vaccine, I think. Yeah. You know, the vaccine doses may be getting pushed out, but they may not end up in the arms. I think some of that money that's been made available isn't actually been used or been able to be used fully. And the reason for that is that there's a lot of strings attached to these funds. Hospitals, our medical school, all have received portions of the CARES Act funds. But they also came with certain stipulations that you had to use them for very specific expenses, and those weren't necessarily the actual expenses that we had. So going back to vaccination again just for a moment, we in theory, there's CARES money that should be able to help us create the infrastructure for giving the vaccine. But it hasn't happened. And some of the extra cost of giving the vaccine wasn't really covered by the CARES Act. So as is true for many things that starts at the federal level and then has to filter through states into local governments, there's bumps in the road and there's things that happen that make it less than fully effective.
You know, you mentioned, you know, the federal level, and obviously there was no national approach in the United States. We have 4% of the world's population and 20% of the world's deaths. What do you think of the state-by-state approach? And, I mean, you can take a look at Texas and New Mexico and see these pretty stark differences. What approach is the right one?
Well, we can look, again, politics.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that we went through this pandemic during an election cycle, particularly a presidential election cycle, because I think it's been very hard to separate state and national politics and party politics from what's probably simply the best health practices. At a time when you have an administration running for re-election that wants to play down the severity of what's actually happening, I don't think that leads to the best decision-making, and I know it led to some conflicts between local government and state government,
mm-hmm.
and you have to believe that the optics of the election had to play a role in that. So I'm glad that we're getting out of that cycle, and I'm glad that we have some new leadership that will take a fresh approach to this. But you have to look at other countries in the world, and particularly some of the countries in Southeast Asia, they had incredibly low numbers of cases due to excellent leadership, excellent control, appropriate lockdowns, as well as public compliance. Japan is now, unfortunately, starting to see a big rise in cases. But for most of this year, they had a very small number of cases. South Korea has done very well. And, you know, these are advanced societies similar to ours who had a much better result than so far we've had.
It's interesting, as a person who lives in El Paso and works in Las Cruces, very early on, El Pasoans really did seem to embrace mask wearing and comply with mask wearing. This is my personal experience of walking around, and it may not be the case at all. Whereas then in New Mexico, where there were, you know, stricter health measures put in place, it seemed like people kind of came around to the mask wearing much later. Why is it that we saw, you know, such reluctance in mask wearing?
You know, I wish I knew. We did get some mixed messaging on masks. Yes. We heard that they were effective, then we heard that they weren't effective. I think people don't like to wear masks because they don't like to cover their face, and I don't think they like to be isolated. We are social beings. I think we want to be around other people. Part of that experience is not only hearing their voice through a piece of cloth, but actually seeing their full face and their mouth. And I just think the human nature is such that people simply don't like doing it, and maybe folks don't realize the risk they're putting themselves or others in by allowing their selfish needs to overrule best practice.
575-646-2212. We have about 15 minutes left with Dr. Michelson on Voice of the Public today. So if you would like to ask a question, please call now with your question, or you can follow along on Facebook Live. And we're always happy to, we're following along and monitoring the comments there. So you can always submit your question on Facebook as well. It is 1:45. And, you know, I wanted to touch on, you know, some of the, like you said, we got conflicting information along the way, but we also got misinformation along the way. What are some of the things that are still out there, Dr. Michelson, that we could clear up for people today?
Well, a few things. One, the vaccine is safe. It's 90 to 95% effective in early trials, and our best hope of reaching herd immunity is for a very large part of the population to get vaccinated. That is our best hope for getting back to something that looks like normal. Two, it is safe to go to hospitals, and if you have to go to the hospital right now, we have capacity. I hope that people don't stay home with unexplained pains or fevers or infections that are getting worse. We are staffed, we're ready to take care of patients, and we really want them to come to the hospital, knowing that they are safe from being exposed to COVID in the hospital. So I want them to do that. Three, we do have good treatments for COVID. And if you unfortunately believe you've become infected and you're becoming symptomatic, by all means, please get checked by your doctor, your clinic, or come to the hospital so that we can check you. Because we do have some good treatments, and they work better if they're given early, particularly the monoclonal antibody treatments. Fourth, please wear your masks. Please try not to share meals indoors because of the possibility of spreading virus particles through the air. Gather outdoors when you can with lots of airflow. It makes a difference, and it's that combination of continuing to practice social distancing, mask wearing, as well as continuing to roll out the vaccination that hopefully by next summer is going to get us back to something that looks more like normal.
Summer of 2021?
Summer of 2021.
All right, John is holding with a question. Thank you for calling Voice of the Public this afternoon. John, go ahead.
Hi, Casey. I have an administrative question to ask. When people receive the vaccine, is it required that you have to sign a liability waiver?
This is another moving target. I'll give you an example from my own experience. When I received my first vaccine, I showed my ID. They checked my name on the list of people who were expected to receive a vaccine. I sat down, someone put a needle in my arm, and then I received my card that indicated the lot number of the vaccine and the date it was given. When I went back for my second dose, the hospitals were told that there has to be a relationship between the person giving the vaccine and the person receiving it. And so I had to fill out a bit of a questionnaire, essentially register like you would register for a clinic visit. And I had to sign a release form before I got my second vaccine. We were not made aware of any of those paper requirements when we got our first dose because it hadn't been pushed out to the hospitals. And by 3 weeks later, when I got my second dose, we had these new requirements in place. So, yes, I believe wherever you go now for a vaccine, you will actually be registered as if you were registering as a patient, and you will have paperwork to review and to sign so that you indicate you understand the risks and benefits, if you will, of receiving the treatment.
Are the terms of that release similar to when you sign up for a trial?
No, it's a little different. And that's a great question. So let me explain the difference. When you sign up for a trial, most trials are randomized, double-blind, with a placebo arm. So that means you are acknowledging that you may only have a 33% or a 50% chance of receiving an active medication or an active vaccine. So part of that consent process is your understanding that you're part of a trial, not part of a defined treatment. the current vaccinations are not part of any trial. They're actually treatment. So it's probably similar to if you were to go for treatment and you needed an injection of penicillin to treat an infection, you would be signing a patient consent form to consent for treatment, understanding that you're being treated and that there's the possibility of having side effects.
So it's considered a valid treatment, even though it's under emergency release.
So the emergency use authorization is the FDA's statement that they have sufficient information to believe what you are receiving is safe and effective, but it falls short of the full review that new therapeutics go through before they become in common use. And if we had to go through the full FDA process, these vaccines probably would have been delayed another 6 months or a year, which was time we didn't have.
Yes, I understand that. Well, thank you very much for your answer.
You're most welcome. Thanks for the question.
All right, John. And 575-646-2212, just about 9 or 10 minutes left. And Patty has been holding, waiting patiently. Thank you, Patty, with your question for Dr. Michelson this afternoon.
Well, this is not really a question for me, but it's something I hear in the community a lot by people who think this is just a hoax, is how is it that we couldn't cure AIDS or anything and yet we got a vaccine so quickly? They all think that's very, very fishy. So can you just give a brief answer to that? And I'll hang up.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of progress, actually, on AIDS. I mean, so I'm old enough that I was an intern in training in Chicago when AIDS was just coming out. And I remember taking care of some of the first AIDS patients in Chicago during my training. The science has come quite a long way since the early 80s when AIDS first emerged. And, gosh, the number of drugs we have and combination drugs we have now, AIDS was a death sentence in the mid-80s when I was in my training. And now we have wonderful medications that fully suppress the virus, and people live essentially normal lives who have HIV and don't go on to develop full-blown AIDS. So, yeah, it's a different virus. Science is amazing in terms of how quickly we've been able to develop effective vaccines for this virus. And unlike AIDS, COVID-19 spreads so much easier. No one got AIDS from eating in the same restaurant as someone else who had an active case of HIV. It required much closer, intimate contact, sharing of needles, etc. Whereas you could ride on the same bus, you could go to the same wedding and be in the same wedding reception as someone with active COVID-19, and then a week later, 30 other people come down with it.
Mm-hmm.
So very different diseases. Yes, they're both viruses, but they're really very different diseases. And I have a lot of confidence in this vaccine based on the tens of thousands of people who went through the trials, enough confidence that I took it myself.
Yeah. And next is Robert. Welcome to Voice of the Public, Robert. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I had a quick question. I don't even know if it pertains to this, but when a patient dies from COVID, does the COVID die with the patient?
Yeah, unfortunately, many patients have died from COVID, and one of the interesting things that isn't talked about a whole lot, we probably have many more deaths that are related to COVID than are even identified, because some people are dying of COVID having never gone to the doctor or having never even been diagnosed. If you look at the numbers of deaths in different parts of the country month by month in 2020 compared to 2019, the number of deaths is up some 20, 25, 30%. So what explains that increase in overall deaths in the country? I mean, really, what's different between those 2 years? The main difference has been COVID-19. There is special handling precautions taken when someone dies of COVID-19 with that person's body, just to make sure. that the people who are handling the body and making arrangements for the funeral don't become exposed. I believe there still is some active virus present after someone dies, but the spread of it obviously is much less because most of that spread is related to breathing and to airflow coming out of your mouth and your lung and your nose.
Yeah. Okay, the question was, what if people, I say, because my mother-in-law passed away from this, and they are not allowed to be buried in normal cemeteries. So her wish was not to be cremated, but since those were the rules over there, that's the only thing, you know, so she had to be cremated for her to be buried in a... Until the day, they're not allowing people to be buried in normal... It has to be a municipal cemetery.
Robert, are you in El Paso?
I am in El Paso.
Okay.
Yeah.
And another thing about the mask, I personally think they ought to make it a mandate, just like, you know, they do with seatbelts.
Yeah.
If you don't wear a seatbelt, you're penalized for it. I personally think they should do the same. It's not like if masks are going to be like this for the rest of our lives. It's going to be at least for this time that, you know, we get through at least over all these cases. That's my opinion.
You know, you're not the first one to say that, and I don't think I have the expertise to answer it. One little difference, if you choose not to wear a seatbelt, you're primarily putting yourself at risk, not others. You're much more likely to die in a car accident if you're not wearing a seatbelt. We know that. That's proven. Masks have much more to do with everyone else. Part of wearing a mask is to protect yourself, but it's also protecting the people who are around you. So in that sense, it's a little bit different. It's a little bit different than the seatbelt example. Let me just say one other good thing about masks. We're in flu season. We're not seeing hardly any cases of influenza. This year in the county, I watch these statistics, and every day I'm seeing 0, 1, 3. By January, we typically have hundreds of cases of influenza and many patients in the hospital with influenza. We're not seeing that this year. So the main difference this year compared to last year, it's not any warmer this winter, I don't think, but people, because they're wearing masks and because they're practicing the distancing for COVID, we have really decreased the number of influenza cases.
Yeah. I do think every winter is warmer than the last, but let's get to Adam. He has been very patient. Thank you for holding, Adam. Welcome to Voice of the Public in our final few minutes here.
Thanks for having me. I've got a two-part question, but I'd kind of like to comment about the last discussion regarding the seatbelt comparison. What I don't understand from a media, from an overall media perspective and from a national leadership standpoint, I don't understand why this hasn't been, you know, the face masking hasn't been more compared to just secondhand smoking. People don't feel like that their rights are being infringed because they can't smoke indoors. So I don't understand why we can't make that kind of comparison. If you're in a public park and there's kids running around, you probably shouldn't be smoking. So why not put a mask on since you're in a public park and you're around other people? If you're inside of a building, you're not going to smoke. So wear a mask because your exhaling is putting other people at risk if you don't have that mask on. So I just want to kind of comment about that comparison. I don't understand why we haven't compared it more to secondhand smoking. But the two-part question that I have is I'm 34, I'm obese. I feel like I've done my part over the last year of remaining as isolated as possible. And I live in Las Cruces, so, and I know a lot of people have asked this question so many different ways, but here we go. When am I going to get the vaccine in Las Cruces, and when am I going to be allowed to to go get a beer somewhere.
Adam.
I keep hearing summer and fall. If I'm vaccinated, I would like to know when I can go get a beer and not feel guilty if I take off my mask.
Let's try to answer your question, Adam, in the 1 minute that we have left.
Sure.
Okay.
Yep. Adam, a very interesting analogy with the secondhand smoke. I think we need to look into that some more. I think you might be onto something there, number one. Number two, with your age and a only risk of obesity, you are in line, probably after the current groups that are being vaccinated. When you're able to, I would register and wait for the phone call. And as far as getting a beer, boy, find some place where you can have it outdoors. You know, find some place that has outdoor seating, so there's lots of air circulating. And as long as you're not sitting 3-4 feet away from someone else drinking their beer, you'll probably be okay.
We do have that option at this point in New Mexico. Patio dining at limited capacity is allowed, but it's a little chilly out. Today's a nice day, however. But Dr. Michelson, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. It was very informative, and we really appreciate your time. We know how valuable it is, and we hope you'll join us again sometime.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thanks to all your listeners who had really great questions.
All right. It is almost time for NPR News, and Leora Zeitlin is coming up with Intermezzo by Request on KRWG Public Media. This is Casey Counts. Thanks for being with us.